Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of This Life. Myself, Dr. Drew.
And Bob Forrest, right here.
And just a second, we were welcoming our guest, Duncan Trussell, in here. But I want to remind people that today's episode is courtesy of Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. And you haven't been out there yet.
I'm going to go out there.
Okay. And so he will be reporting in detail. He's going to go in there with a microscope.
Well, that's what we want to do, right? We want to be consultants and go out and help rehabs become more standardized.
So I've been talking to these folks, and the reason we accepted them as a sponsor is they are old school recovery. I mean, everybody there, it was like I felt like I'd been lost in the woods, and I came out, and everyone spoke my language. They understood what I was talking about. So it was kind of, I was pretty psyched to find that. So, and
there's little hamlets of that here in LA too, Drew. There really
is. I understand, but I don't get to talk to them very often. So when I talk to somebody that says,
they're always shucksters come talk to you.
No, literally, when I went, would you guys give me replacement therapies? And they're like, what? Why would we do that? We talk about recovery. We do CBT. We do DBT. We give psychotherapy. We have groups. We help people heal. We're not worrying about replacement therapies. So it was good. It's a good place. So,
and they you know, the main criticism I have of the recovery industry is they lead with the food and the accommodations.
No. I didn't even hear about that. I have no idea. I just know it's Montana. That's not so bad. So, so, I love, well, you'll tell me. You'll find it.
I'm
go investigate deeply.
I'm looking forward to it.
So
actually,
let me introduce our guest. Our guest is Duncan Trussell. Duncan is a good friend. He's a super interesting guy that I was dying to have you meet, Bob. I just think it'd be an interesting conversation between you two. And as usual, I'm sure there'll be more common than not, in common than Discord.
Ram Dass. I know Ram Dass.
Well, let's start
there.
Start with that.
Great.
So wait, you got your podcast.
Yes.
Let's go ahead and pitch that.
It's the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, and it's on iTunes.
I've been on a couple of those. It's
yes,
fun
you
as
have.
Hell. And
you're a great guest.
Fred Stoller's done it with
yes,
us.
Yes, that was
Fred,
a blast.
Fred was funny. He wants to do another. Fred's got an infection in his leg right now.
Oh, no.
Been getting him through that all weekend. But he's going to be fine. I should have talked to him today. You talked to him? No. I'm talking to my wife. So Duncan, Ram Dass, let's start with that.
Ram Dass, I've gone to a couple of things that he's done at the Self-Realization Fellowship in Malibu.
Oh, cool.
You know, whatever it is on Pacific Palisades.
Yeah.
You notice that one of the things I'm very antisocial is what Dr. Drew calls me. That's a technical term. I'm just a very questioning, kind of cautious guy.
Don't ask him to do something or follow a rule.
Oh, good.
It won't happen.
So, yeah, that's smart.
So I was going to Self-Realization. I was a member of Self-Realization Fellowship about 10 years ago. Very, very much thought, oh my gosh, this is the way at least some religion should be.
Sure.
Till I was walking out one Sunday and I looked at the parking lot. And it was all Porsches Range Rovers. And I thought, you know what? If this is the word of God, if this is how to live, why isn't there one in South Central? Why isn't there one in Texas? Why isn't there one? Why are all the self-help movements in Malibu and Santa Monica and catering to a narcissistic culture that wants to hear they're really good for recycling their trash and giving $20 to poor people?
Sure.
You know, and I left the church immediately.
Have you ever? That's hilarious. That's it. Have you ever read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it's fantastic.
It's been going on for 100 years.
Yeah.
That's really what you're saying.
Well, no. It's the Screwtape Letters. You know the Screwtape Letters.
No, tell me.
It's letters from like an elderly demon to an up and coming demon about how to tempt human beings.
Yeah. How to get it going on.
And C.S. Lewis was Christian.
Yeah,
so it's
famous Christian author.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
how to appeal to people's greed and
right. How do you get them?
How do you get them?
So you know, this young demon, I guess, you never really, you don't see the writing from the young demon. It's always as though the older demon is responding to this younger demon. And so the younger demon is freaking out because the human he's been assigned to has started going to church. And so the older demon is saying to him, this is a fantastic thing.
This is when they get really fucked up.
Now we got him.
And the older demon is saying, you know, all you have to do is turn his mind towards the flaws in the people in the congregation. Turn his mind to what's wrong with him and use that to help destroy or erode whatever the church itself. So this thing that your mind is doing there, and it's a completely reasonable thing to think, is you're getting caught up in judgment, because you're mm-hmm. now what you're doing.
Well, all life is judgment,
right? And in this particular case, it's like going to a hospital and looking around and thinking, look at all these sick motherfuckers. Why do they come here? This hospital must not work. And I think that a lot of people, you know, on all levels of the spectrum of wealth.
Well, religion and spirituality is separate from other things that are practical, like going to a hospital.
If I could just do a side, though, for a second. Do you understand?
There's a big difference between a hospital and a church.
I disagree. I think Duncan's analogy is exactly right. And I think if you weren't so antisocial, you would have looked around that parking lot and went, oh my God, this church is really working. Everybody succeeds and thrives. All they have to do is come to this church.
That's a positive way to look at it, too.
As opposed to
it's
your
a naive
bullshit.
Way of looking at
your
it.
Bullshit yeah. is why rich people do it here. Why
no, we... no, no. That they cater to a very elite crowd so they get donations so they yes. can have their things
yeah.
and
yes.
wear their expensive gowns sure. and have their $500 pillows that yep. they sit on.
Yeah.
Listen, you're not right? wrong.
Well, no, you're definitely
you're just antisocial.
You're not wrong, but I think that with all religion, no matter what it is,
just so you know, I think it should all be outlawed.
All religion.
All religion. All religion should be outlawed. Yeah, I'm an old commie from way back.
Fucking, you're a Stalinist. Even Lenin thought there was some room for it.
When Trump is all on the Muslims, I'm like, good, let's get rid of that Muslim religion and the Christian religion and Judaism. Even
send
though
your
I like
letters
Judaism
where? Bob,
best
your,
of all.
What? So you are an, you hate all religion.
I think religion is... not necessary.
How do you
and
deal
we're
with
we're told that it's not necessary.
But you have a God
that,
concept,
that it is
though.
Necessary.
Yes? You have a, huh? You're agnostic.
Very
more
much
than,
community, yeah. people, children. We need to care about children. Religion doesn't care about children at all.
Wow.
It cares about money.
Oh my God, that is such a sweeping, incredibly sweeping generalization. I'm not a religious person. I haven't gone to church in ages.
Yeah.
And, but I can't imagine.
That's why you got cancer.
Creating such. I can't imagine. Somehow pigeonholing.
No, you got to say
world.
Statements. They're making dramatic statements because I don't see that our society is getting better from all this religion. America's the most religious society in the world. Mm. We have all kinds of respect for religion.
Well,
yet our children can't read. They murder each other.
And you're blaming that on religion?
If that's the moral compass that's directing this country's moral kind of direction... The churches are failing the people.
I don't see religion. I would say the trouble's coming.
So blame
more.
Technology.
I'd blame Justin Bieber before I blame religion.
Then now you're getting my kind of talking. I could blame Justin's got a little part of this.
No, I would blame.
No, hip hop, rap music,
Disney. I mean, why not start with Disney if you really want to look at what the needle that's going into the zeitgeist or what's filling up the paradigm with the symbols, I'd say that you're looking more at
Mickey Mouse and
look at Frozen, for example. I my nephew just came to visit. It's amazing to have a nephew and to be an uncle. And you'd start, you know, wigging out.
How old is he?
Two. Oh. Terrible twos. Yeah. So he'd start like, you know, whatever, something would like upset him. We'd be at a restaurant and worst case scenario, the safety parachute is my brother would show him Frozen on his phone. Yeah. And to watch the tranquilizing yeah. effect of Frozen is incredible.
Yeah.
But if you look at Frozen, I just finally watched it on an airplane, and you look at, like, what is Frozen about? You know, have you seen Frozen
yeah,
yet?
I've seen it several times. I'm a five-year-old.
Okay, there you go. So it's like...
Probably 100 times.
It's an innocuous thing if it's on the surface, but then when you really look at, like, what you have there, and this should appeal to the communist side of you, you have a very wealthy family. It's accepted that they're a super wealthy family. It's accepted.
And it's okay.
And it's
okay. It
reinforces
that.
Right.
It have and have not.
That, yeah. So that, to me, is far more nefarious than religion, which is such a broad term anyway, because there's so many different sects and denominations and and you've got the, what is it? What's it called? The Universal Church. What's that?
Yeah.
The Unitarian Universalists, who sort of have this broad spectrum of POVs. You've got Catholicism. You've got the, what's it? The Phelps family, the God hate. Oh, is that what they are? The God hates fags family.
Yeah, I don't remember their name. But
yeah. So military people.
You get this entire spectrum.
Yeah.
And
all of it seems pretty worthless.
I don't think it's worthless because what it's
if you told people you don't need that to be a good person, you can help your community.
Yeah, but you're looking only strictly from the perspective of it creating a moral compass.
And I think
motivation.
Many religions do say that. They do say this is not, there's nothing essential in this. It's just something that is allowing you to be around a community of people who generally have something in common.
Who generally it is to divide and identify people who don't
agree.
Most
churches I've been to, it seems like what people have in common is they're trying to find out ways to explore themselves spiritually with a group of people who are wanting to improve themselves. I have been, I guess when I was younger, much, much younger, I have been in like a typical, you know, hardcore religious environment where it does seem to be a lot of judgment and darkness there. But usually when you get around, depending on the church, like
that's people you're talking about. You're talking about people religion assumes that people are inherently evil.
Certain religions.
Oh, no,
right?
That's not true.
Oh,
certain,
yes. All Judeo-Christian religions.
Certainly
that
not.
Man
not,
is evil.
Not Buddhism.
But he comes from sort of Eastern perspective.
Yeah,
that's
But you know, you're just saying religion.
But life, Buddhism is life is suffering.
You mean
very similar,
but that's not saying all people are evil.
Life is beautiful and exciting too.
Well, Buddhism starts with life is suffering, but then it says the cause of suffering
is attachment.
One
is
thing.
Attachment.
Yeah.
So
do you know who Shenzhen Young is?
No, I don't.
Okay, so he's the one I was a Buddhist for years, and I studied, and I meditated, and
sure.
I went to retreats, and I did all that kind of stuff. And it's illogical or unreasonable, me born a Western mind, to think that I even want non-attachment.
Right.
I don't. We are in like you said, Disney taught me before I even had consciousness to have attachment. So I'm setting myself up for either deluding myself that I really don't want attachment to my children, to my community,
I see what you're saying.
So why am I doing something that the ultimate goal of it is to have something I don't want?
Well, the term, so the word, it's so easy in semantics of these things. So attachment, yeah, I get what you're saying. So people hear non-attachment and they think that some people see it, and I'm not saying you do, but some people see it as a kind of Vulcan-esque approach to the world where you're detached and therefore there's this kind of passionless emptiness, this all-pervading nothingness where you aren't falling in love, you're not experiencing.
I found it very competitive, Buddhism.
What's that?
I found Buddhism very competitive.
Well, again, this is, it's what kind of Buddhism?
Zen.
Zen can be very austere.
But it's a matter of how long you can meditate for. At a certain point, I was meditating 5 hours
that's
a day.
Hilarious.
5 hours a day.
He's competing for a better Zen.
No, this is before that. But that becomes very much, and I'm specifically talking about Los Angeles because this is where we live. This is madness, this town.
Yes.
This is madness.
Yes.
To try to talk about Buddhism and God and.
Well, listen to Duncan's stuff. Duncan's got some really interesting points for you, though. So go ahead. What's your sort of take on all this?
Well, I mean, because I can remember in college, we were studying the Bhagavad Gita and a lot of stuff about not being attached.
Death.
I think the verse in particular that really upset some people in the class was, and I'm going to butcher it because I don't have the thing memorized, but something like a wise man is not disturbed by the appearance of happiness or distress because these things come and go like the seasons. Mm-hmm. And so to get caught up in any given moment is a foolish thing, because if you do that, then you are going to be caught like a kite in the wind. And
snapshot life is another way of putting it.
Yeah. So that's a great way to put it. So detachment isn't a thing that is supposed to keep you from loving your family. And my brother, you know, came to visit and he's getting into mindfulness. He was just asking me about this, saying, you know, this oneness, this emptiness that they talk about, this non-self. How do I have that and at the same time love my child?
That's what I'm talking
right.
about.
Right. That's the question.
That's
a
big question.
That's a great question, too. It's a really great question.
Is that what I'm trying to achieve is what my journey was? Well, is that ultimately what I'm trying to achieve, to have non-attachment, to have no attachment?
Well, we want, I would think, to me, the core, most fundamental and essential aspect to a happy life is love. We need love. Love is the best thing.
Attachment is a piece of love. Attachment is in love.
Well, I think that is where I would probably, if you guys think that, I used to think that, I would disagree with that.
Okay.
I would say that attachment is a thing that keeps you from fully experiencing love, because my experience has been quite often that if I'm feeling love, there's a generally a kind of
fear that it's going to go away.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, man. And it's the same feeling you get when you if you're on a wonderful drug, which you have experience with.
Yeah.
It's that bummer feeling when you're coming off
run
of
off.
Yeah, when you're coming off of ecstasy, that terrible, dire feeling when the
but then getting back to a more religious perspective is you can live in faith of love, right? And that you have faith that love exists, that you kind of migrate in and out of it. You don't have to fear that it will not return as you realize it's leaving.
Yeah, or
isn't wouldn't a better way of looking at it? You can be attached to a person, but you shouldn't be attached to love.
Well, or you could. So I think being attached to a person quite often can be a form of aggression because
control. Yeah.
So why are you attached to the person? You're attached to the person quite often if it in a relationship or. Any kind, whatever the relationship is, you generally an intimate relationship, you've allowed yourself to think the person is that which dispenses love into your life. So you've turned this person into a kind of dope dealer dispensing love.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, that's what it is. And so you get really hung up and you start getting really afraid that your supply is going to go away. And that's when you're in the cell phone looking
now
at text.
You're talking
and,
my language.
Yeah, that's
I
it.
I know about suppliers going away.
That's it.
That's a very worrisome thing.
And that's attachment. And that's attachment. That is the.
Do you think that's what your son's experiencing when he's attached to you?
No.
Wait a minute.
No, but what?
Well, wait a minute. I thought that we just decided what attachment
was. No, I'm
was.
Saying that this is all from people's perspective, adults' perspective who are seeking.
Okay,
I think
so we're not talking about attachment, the biological system that
no, the
lets
neural
the duckling follow the mom or
no,
the, you know, the attachment
No, I know
system,
what you mean.
So you're
talking about love. Romantic love is what
you're talking
really
about. Intimate attachment.
Or not. That it's attachment to, you know, I got this email from a friend of mine who's having some problems. Because he's taking care of his parents. His mom got really sick. Now he's taking care of his mom. And 90% of the day is spent taking care of his mom. And it's a very, very stressful place to get into.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the stress is for him was coming from his perception that this is going to last forever. I'm going to be taking care of my mom for forever. Right. And so that's the other way attachment works is some situation emerges into your life. You get sick. You're out of money. Your business isn't doing so well. And you begin to think this is going to last forever. Mm-hmm. It's never going to get better. And this is attachment, too. And this is why the word for attachment is translated not just to attachment, to clinging. Clinging. So it's a clinginess.
So that I know where you're going with it. So my thing is I'm everything and nothing, right? So I went for 5 years with Buddhism. I was
this,
raised
this
Catholic.
All sound, what's the psychiatrist that was in the concentration camp, a Jewish?
This is Viktor Frankl.
It sounds like Frankl.
Yeah, the man's search for meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are we all agree with that's Frankl stuff, right?
Well, that is, you're talking about logos therapy, I think is what he called it.
Yeah,
well,
he had some weird ideas, but he experienced weird... of like, everything, you know, you can tolerate anything, everything passes.
Right. Well, yeah. that is.
And you can become anything. That's what he was saying, that in the concentration camp, you have no idea of who you could become in order to survive.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he became the person who picks who's sick and who should go and who stays. It's kind of, I don't think it's something you ever get over.
Yeah.
Right?
But How could you?
So what I'm saying is, you take in all this information like we go to school. It's like spiritual school.
Yes.
And then you integrate and make something make sense to you, and it only needs to make sense to you.
Yes.
That's what I've done.
That's for sure.
And so I learned a lot of things from Buddhism, a lot of things from Catholicism. Once you're free of things, you can like really be. So here's the thing. Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. We don't know about chopping wood and carrying water in the society of how important it is
to
do your job well, to raise your children
being
well,
in the moment,
to do excellently, to be in the moment.
Yes.
That sort of thing, whether it's AA or Buddhism or Catholicism, it gets all of those things get too caught up in dogma.
Mm.
And I just want to be free and chop wood, carry water.
Love it.
you know, and mostly focus on children because I have to deal with adult drug addicts and they're so difficult.
Yeah.
So I've been able to.
But so much of what you're seeing in those adults is because of childhood injuries.
Poor childhood. Yeah. So I just mostly focus on children the last 5, 10, 6 years. Child issues. I don't fundraise for drug programs anymore.
Right.
No Kid Hungry, Children's Music School, things that involve children, because I do believe we can influence children in a positive way, even if their parents are fucked up.
Yeah, I would hope so. That's really cool. So that's what you do. That's great.
But I like to come on with the anti-religion thing.
Sure, it's fun.
Well, now wait. Let me do a quick thing. Let me take a quick break and we get back. Duncan takes this to another level once you get into, okay? I'd like to introduce you all to our latest sponsor. It is the Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. They're in Montana. And if you've been listening to anything that Bob and I have been talking about over the years, you know that we're very particular about an addiction treatment. And we don't take recommendations lightly, so we've looked into these guys pretty carefully. And the Rocky Mountain Treatment Center happens to be one I am able to recommend, and I'm happy to do so. They focus on individualized treatment of the patients, including their entire well-being based on a biopsychosocial model. This is what Bob and I have done for years and years. They don't just look at addiction. They look at the psychiatric issues, the psychological issues, the trauma issues, all aspects of the physical and mental health. And of course, you've heard me stress the importance of this for long-term success. There's staying sober, but there's what I call real recovery, which is dealing with all the risk factors that set people up for bad addiction. They're in Great Falls, Montana. It's a 26-bed facility surrounded by amazing Montana landscape. Patients can have a range of recreational therapies, including equine therapy. For more information on Rocky Mountain Treatment Center, click on their banner on the thislifepodcast.com website or at drdrew.com, or visit their site at rocky.rehab. That is simply rocky.rehab. All right, welcome back. This Life. And Bob, you see why I love Duncan so much.
Yeah, yeah.
I first fell in love with Duncan when I saw him drink a bottle of absinthe and a bottle of vodka like that. And tell the history of Tesla.
Drunk history.
And then had it acted out by Philip Seymour.
Crispin Glover.
And Jace.
I can't believe I can't remember.
He lives in this town, too, this guy.
He's so John C. Reilly.
John C. Reilly. And it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my entire fucking
life. About Tesla?
Who's an amazing story.
Man.
Yeah, amazing story.
Amazing.
It's strange that my son just told me he had sort of a weird kind of insight. He's a mathematician. He had some weird insight sort of during meditation. Very similar to Tesla seeing the alternating
current.
Your
son did?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And anyway, so...
You were also on Drunk History with him.
Yes, and then I did Drunk History, and unbeknownst to me, the episode I was on, Duncan's Drunk History episode.
That's right, Lemley.
About Tesla and Lemley.
Yeah.
I mean, Edison and Lemley.
Yep.
And it was good. It was really good.
Yeah, and, man. I wish I could say who I get to do the next one. Oh, I'm so excited.
Oh,
I can't talk about it, though.
Will you tell Derek, please, that I would actually like to act on it, whatever
yes.
it is?
Yes.
Okay,
you'd be perfect for
please
this one,
him,
too.
Please
okay,
tell
cool.
him. I'm in.
I'll tell him.
I love that.
My favorite quote was when you called him a greedy reptilian shitbag. Oh, my God.
And those words are coming out of my mouth.
I posted
and
it
then,
on
and then
were you
goes,
drunk?
No, I'm acting his words.
Yeah.
You have to see Drunk History. He tells the story, and then we act it out.
They get you hammered. They've got a nurse
there. Yeah, no, I've seen it. It seems like somebody gets really drunk.
He goes, you can't be in control of all the films made in the world, you cunt. And so I'm screaming, you cunt.
Because Edison was trying to control.
And during... You saw it. We had the premiere of this season, and they have me yelling, you cunt.
It was great. It's so cool to see that, too, man. I'm so happy they did that. To see my weird voice coming out of your mouth is hilarious.
So anyway, we became friends. I've done his podcast a few times. He very kindly asked us to do his – he has sort of a stand-up podcast and stand-up. Any dates coming up?
Yeah, I've got a huge tour coming up next year. It's going to be on the website, DuncanTrussell.com.
Okay. See Duncan Trussell's comedy. It's as you get the sense, it's smart comedy, right?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Now, but Duncan does this thing where he takes it to a whole other level. All this stuff with the hallucinogens and the, you know, and the he said something to me to made a little sense about hallucinogens. We were sort of back and forth about this, and obviously I just worry about people hurting themselves with these things.
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, I'll tell you the one thing that I think of it. Correct me if I'm misspeaking here. is that it's like taking an elevator to a top level. The doors open up. You get to see these marvelous things. And then when that chemical wears off, the drugs, the doors close and you go back down.
Yes. So, yeah. Dick Alpert, Ram Dass, that was his big problem, is they were taking massive doses of LSD, like horrifying doses of LSD.
With Leary.
And they were to the point.
Ooh, Drew's going to freak out. Leary was a friend of mine.
Wow, well, awesome.
I saw him later in life, and he couldn't figure out how to put a pair of headphones in his head.
Whatever
it all was, it had damaged his brain by the time I saw him.
Well, this is, and those two kind of, there's a great new documentary about Ram Dass and Tim Leary called Dying to Know, which sort of shows their strange relationship. Millbrook. But you know, they took two different paths. Mm. And Alpert got
Timothy
to the...
Timothy loved fame. That's what he loved.
Yeah, I mean, and what an easy thing to love, too, you know?
By the way, who don't you know, Bob Forrest?
I know. It was one of the weirdest experiences of my life one night at his house. Don't even ask.
But you're not the first person to say that.
First of all... You're going to leave it at that? You don't expect me to want
well,
to know what the hell you're talking
about? Well, he lived above Cello Drive. That's why I wanted to go there. He lived right above the Manson house. And I'm kind of obsessed with Manson a little bit. So everybody's wanted to go over there. And I just felt like, oh, it's a bunch of celebrity ass kissing bullshit. But then one night, a friend of mine was freaking out, had taken some of his drugs, which he thought was cocaine. And it was white powdered MDMA.
Mescaline,
rather. And this friend of mine, who's a very famous musician, was losing his mind. So I went over there and for 5 hours around Tim's house, like walking my friend around, going to the backyard and
was Tim there?
Yeah, he was there.
Did he know what to do?
He was not really, it was late at night. Oh, he was conked out.
He didn't give a shit.
And so, but the sense I always got about Timothy was he loved fame. He loved famous people. He's very, very much like a Mad Men type guy. Not like a spiritual guy like Ram Dass, more like a salesman type guy.
Yeah,
I don't know. He was a brilliant guy, and
yes,
he invented
group therapy. He told me, which I think is true.
One of my favorite stories. One of my favorite stories about him, when he was on trial, and this is before he got locked up, but he actually escaped from prison. That they got him to he got them to put him in a minimum security prison, and the way he did that is the test that they administered to figure out what prison to put him in, he created the test.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, so he was able to, like, he knew the test, knew exactly the right answers to give to get into prison.
He
was
a lot of those
from
Wexel, all the personality inventories and stuff. He was
at
very,
Harvard, was he at
Stanford?
Harvard?
Yeah,
Stanford,
Harvard,
Harvard,
well, Harvard.
Yeah.
So, but getting to that whole gang of people, what they did was, because I love the history of drugs, and I love drugs, and I love it all the stories and whatever. Set and setting is very important to a hallucinogenic experience. Yes. And they didn't emphasize enough personal responsibility of set and setting right off the bat. So Kesey then goes nuts and gives it to anybody he can fuck or Neil Cassidy. They just went around wanting to meet young girls. I mean, that's what the...
Kesey,
yeah.
Who's that?
That the electric Kool-Aid acid test.
Yeah.
The electric Kool-Aid acid test.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really about free love and sex and the hedonism that comes on later. So it goes from Millbrook to that, like in a matter of like 4 years.
Well, these were two.
So now by the time that gets to the masses, they don't know. You're supposed to be like in a real special place loving people around you.
Right. These two. So you're talking about these two, basically these two tribes.
The evolution of LSD in America.
Right, but you're sort of bringing these two tribes together. You had Alpert and Leary, which are these kinds of sophisticated Ivy League doctors who are taking...
Well, somebody had to give the chemical
compound to
the public.
You know who gave it? It was the government. The government gave it to Kesey. Kesey's first introduction to LSD was through the...
I heard that.
Yeah, so that's how I got into...
But he couldn't have figured out what the compounds are of how to make it and mass produce it.
Well, Kesey and the bus...
Neil Cassidy,
seemingly very annoying. If you watch the documentary, he seems like the most annoying man on earth. But this
is sociopath.
He seems just like kind of like a stammering, annoying guy who got.
You know about this? It's Marty. Dean Moriarty from On the Road was the driver of the bus where they went around the Merry Pranksters and gave LSD to people, telling them really not very good information about what the power of it was.
That's not the Leary camp. That was a different
camp. No, I know. But I'm saying Leary was the one that took out of Harvard and goes to Millbrook and lives in that house with a bunch of girls and a bunch of crazy stuff. But it was intellectual... kind of a chain of command.
Yeah, that's that house. That's right.
Then it goes to San Francisco with Kesey and Neil Cassidy, and there's no chain of command. Right. It's just chaos. And that's what then gets introduced. LSD gets introduced in the public consciousness on a mass way. Just take it. You're going to love it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
The Beatles were sort of behind that same idea too, remember?
I think they pushed it out. They met Leary, though, in 66, I think, 65 probably.
But, you know, Leary and Alpert and I can't remember, Metzner wrote a book called The Psychedelic Experience, which was based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it's like one, if anyone listening is going to take a psychedelic for the first time, check out that book because it has a very...
The Tibetan book or the other one?
It's based, they've converted the dying process detailed in the Tibetan Book of the Dead into something that applies to a trip.
And by the way, there's some, I sent you that New Yorker article. I don't know if you ever got
the
it.
The one about psilocybin?
And the guy dying? In the dying process, that they're finding clinically some very useful.
Very useful.
Make people more accepting of the dying process, which is wild.
Yeah. That was important. The ecstasy thing, right?
No, I think it was psilocybin. It might have been LSD.
Well, they're
giving ecstasy too.
Yeah, that's for PTSD, which is a little scarier. But this stuff, hey, you're dying anyway, and this is helping people?
It's helping people overcome the massive amount of anxiety that comes from knowing that you're going to die and the fear associated with it.
All know we're going to die.
No, but somebody with terminal cancer.
Something about having an actual date.
We've actually both been through cancer, so we literally had our face to the mirror a little bit.
It's quite anxiety provoking. Yeah.
Remember when Magic Johnson said, "I'm going to beat this," and how we all thought, like, "What a delusional motherfucker!"
Yeah.
Well, look what happened.
Yeah, but that was
there's
the
something
right
about
time.
The mind.
No, that was timing. Timing.
There was nothing
timing.
About his positive
Dude.
Attitude.
Timing.
Doctor. That's a doctor for you. they don't want to hear that hippie shit.
If
man.
He thought he was going to die and it was a death sentence, I don't know that he. You know what I mean? You got to have medicine meet spirit somehow.
I
agree with you there, man.
You're not a spirit guy. No, I am, but I'm also a biologist, you know what I mean? It's like, this is AIDS we're talking about.
But I have people that were diagnosed before 91 when he was that are still alive. They lived those 5 years up until the antiviral revolution.
Which is, but for the grace of God. I mean, if you want to get spiritual, that's the spiritual thing, is why what was that? Why did they, certain viruses behave differently in different people's systems?
Right. Isn't that crazy? There's people that I've known that have had HIV or AIDS, whatever you want to call it, since it was called ARC in like 84.
Nuts.
AIDS-related complex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nuts.
I hate to say it, Drew, this is going to sound crazy. They're all very much like Magic Johnson personalities. Like, I'm going to fucking do whatever it takes to survive this. And there was other friends of mine thought of it as a death
sentence.
They
alcoholics?
Yeah. Well, the one I'm thinking of is,
You know, they're good survivors. Oh, I'm not kidding. I mean, they're hardy. They're made up a certain way.
That's fascinating. Yeah. You have such an interesting respect for alcoholics. I think that, and for drug addicts. I think that's such a beautiful thing. And I think that's why you're so good at treating them. And you do too, I can tell. There's something so sweet about that. And I think a lot of people, they think that you have a kind of, you're like a nemesis of the addict or something. I've never seen more of someone who's more of an ally, someone who understands the psyche. So it's so interesting.
Yeah, people think I'm the narc dude.
You're the opposite of that. That's one of the great confusions about you is that you're somehow against it. You have such a deep compassion. You're the most compassionate person I've ever met when it comes to people who are caught in that terrible tar pit.
Yeah,
and I'm sure you are too. We've never had a conversation.
I know.
Bob's antisocial. He doesn't care.
I've never met somebody who knew so much who also felt like I felt about addicts and about these subjects and about life, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that you know, alcoholics are the most interesting people, to tell you the truth.
Right.
From Alexander the Great on down to Churchill, to Jimi Hendrix, to, you know, John Lennon, whoever you want to say, to Ram Dass. To,
was Ram Dass an alcoholic?
I don't think he was an alcoholic.
Well, Alan Watts was, for sure.
For sure. I don't think he was, and I don't think he had any, like, was trying to hide that either.
You know who Alan Watts is?
No.
Oh, my God. The guy.
He was really a great writer.
He wrote a book about attachment called the Something of Selfishness, or what was
it? Oh, gosh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it was a really good book. Like,
he was a great lecturer, and what he did.
He was shit-faced drunk a lot of the time.
What he did that was brilliant. He avoided the guru route because he was someone who was just an incredible lecturer, and you can go on YouTube and find all kinds of Alan Watts lectures. He talks about Taoism, Zen, Confucianism, but he got out of the guru trip by saying that he was a spiritual entertainer. So what that meant is he could drink up there. Interestingly enough, you know, another very famous alcoholic guru is Chogyam Trungpa, who you should check him out. He's got a great documentary on Netflix called Crazy Wisdom. He was a apostate Tibetan Buddhist who has written one of the great books on Tibetan Buddhism called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, which actually I think you would like a lot.
Yeah.
And but he would drink.
What was the guy that moved to Santa Barbara that begins with a K, long name, who disavowed being a guru?
I don't know.
Wrote a bunch of books. He lived in Santa Barbara.
I'm not sure.
Anyway, I read some of his stuff. And then, you know, the Yogananda himself says one of the greatest things in the Diary of a Yogi, it's documented, where he does the American, he's told in a vision to go teach meditation to America.
Yes.
Right? And he comes here and nobody really wants to hear it.
Right.
So then at the end of the tour, I think in Boston or something, he tells his followers, reschedule another event in Los Angeles and charge $3. And they're all like doubting their guru now. Like, dude, are you fucking kidding? Nobody's coming to this. We got to go back home.
You're right.
To India.
Smart.
These people are fucking stupid.
Yeah.
You can see all the contempt the monks had or the followers had, right? And they're like, and then he comes to Los Angeles, does another one for $3 when it was free the first time and nobody came, and it's packed. And all the followers are like, Master, how did you know that? And he's like, I studied the people and I realized they don't value anything they don't pay for.
Yeah, isn't that wild? What a great analysis.
What a great, astute kind of perception of America.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's why religion has to have a price tag on it. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't. I'm just saying, at a certain point, I couldn't buy into it.
Right.
Because of so much focus towards abundance, whether it's the secret and their abundance. And God wants you to have a Cadillac.
But you know, this is going to seem like a weird kind of non sequitur, but it isn't. So have you heard Ryan Adams' remake of Taylor Swift's?
No, but I want to get it.
Oh, my Christ. It's so good. It's so
good.
Well,
his version of Wonderwall is better than Oasis.
Oh, wait till you hear it. You got to listen to it because, you know, this is something where, you know, the Taylor Swift, I'm not musically adept enough or spiritually adept enough to do what a lot of smart people do where they can find in music, in Taylor Swift,
the lyrics,
beauty, right? Yeah. So, and that's what Ryan Adams has demonstrated in this incredible alchemical feat. He's taken this thing, which is just like you know, being consumed by 14-year-old girls who are shrieking over it, that if you hear it, it just sounds really, to me, I just don't like it. I don't like the manipulative quality of the music, the way it sticks in your head. But then he takes it, brings out the essence of the lyrics, which in a few of the songs is a very deep,
what's he from, Ryan?
Deep sadness.
Ryan was in Whiskey Town.
Okay.
He's amazing.
I've heard about this.
But it's incredible.
He did a cover of the entire album.
Have you seen his documentary, Bob and the Monster?
No, I have not.
He was in a famous rock band in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
Thelonious Monster.
Oh, wow. Cool. Okay, cool.
I just learned on the internet with the death of Lemmy Kilmister, one of my heroes. 30 years ago this month, Thelonious Monster opened for Motorhead at the Olympic Auditorium.
Oh, wow.
30 years, on December 7th, 1985.
Wow.
That's how old I am.
Wow. I think that's 40.
Lemmy's dead, and I'm doing a podcast with you and Dr. Drew.
Wow. Here's my point, though, is that what Ryan Adams
did. He
can
extract the beauty out of it.
So, and I think that.
And your religion, can you do that?
I think you can do that.
Can.
And so you can go into any. You know, I had this professor when I was, that really like was an amazing guy, Sam Scovel, at this little liberal arts school I went to.
Where?
In Asheville, North Carolina, oh, that's right. Warren Wilson College.
Oh, I love Asheville.
Beautiful
that
place.
Down the gully where all the thrift stores are.
It's amazing.
So beautiful.
Lexington there. Avenue is what you're thinking. Yeah, but
it's so great.
He, one of the things he would say is that he could listen to fundamentalist Christian radio and extract wisdom from it and throw the rest away.
Yeah.
And that if that the modality you want to get into, not just with a religion, not just with music, but with all things, is to become a kind of phenomenological filter, so that what you're doing is you're taking phenomena, the phenomena that doesn't appeal to you or is clearly skewed or wrong, throw it away, but that find inside of it, you'll find these veins of gold.
And see, the reason why I was kind of doing that broad stroke of religion is because the Christian nation America is now focusing on what they don't like about the Quran.
Yeah.
And now they're going to demonize a religion.
Yes.
And it's not just Donald Trump. It's ruminating and really clicking with millions of Americans.
I got to tell you, I did
something they know nothing about.
Listen, I did a television show. They had an audience full of Muslim, and I just had them come down and tell me their concerns and what it's like. They're all like professionals and smart and rich.
Yeah.
And
same as everybody else.
Same as everybody else. And our show got hashtags for viewers. I mean, it was like nobody when it was interested.
Wow.
And to me, it was a deeply moving experience. I was like, oh.
Yeah, people.
And something weird is going on in this society, so I just like to say broad strokes. Listen,
sure.
The Christians marched from Europe to Jerusalem and killed anyone who didn't accept Christ.
Yeah.
That was, you know. That.
It's 1,500 years ago, to be fair.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, man.
Yeah.
Hey, religion is religion is religion, whatever century you want to pick it out of. And we got some wacky shit going on. But here's my thing. All this focus on San Bernardino, and I know that when you're spiritual, you have to look at the world that we live in, right?
Yeah.
So 14 kids. Another 100 kids have gotten murdered in Chicago in the time we've been talking about that. And the president of the United States is from Chicago, and he's never gone there one time.
Oh, wow.
And the mayor of Chicago is the guy who got the President Obama in office, one of the most ruthless politicians in the
world.
Rahm Emanuel, right? Shouldn't we be equally distraught as a society about what's going on in Chicago as we are about what happened in San Bernardino?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you look at the Google clicks.
Well,
the Google clicks
are
10 million anti-Muslims to one.
The problem, Bob, is somebody has stood up again. We're coming for you. We're organizing it. We're going to get you. The boogeyman's coming. And that's that's the part that gets up. You're like, well, hold on a second here. Yeah, as opposed to, it's a disaster in Chicago. It's horrible. We got to do something about that. As opposed to, who's coming? Are they going to bomb? Are they going to come to my house? I go, huh?
And look how they dress. Yeah. They wear like Mexican wrestler
would love
outfits.
This. So I had to fly 3 days after 9/11, and they had you meet in Lot C, and then you had to take a bus into the airport.
Whoa.
Remember that?
Yeah.
The first weeks after 9/11. And I'm on this thing, and I'm pretty spiritually, knowledgeable. And there's these Sikhs on there, right? And this old lady goes, "Have they been checked? Have they been checked?" And these poor fucking Sikhs are like, "Jeez, we're not Muslim."
Oh, poor Sikhs have got it rough right now.
I know.
They do. Poor Sikhs.
I know.
They got it rough.
Imagine if they dress with pockets on the sides and the socks like the Christians.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to the hallucinogen thing, because Duncan has some really interesting ideas about hallucinogens versus should they be used, not used. And they should be used. Okay.
They should be used.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that, it's they should be used responsibly, and they should be used, theoretically.
The problem you're having is a small minority of the society now are seekers.
Yes.
All the rest of the society are followers. They don't really want to know what hallucinogens can open you up to.
Right.
They don't. I don't think they can handle it.
But how do we navigate this? Because it's not good for you.
I'm not taking it. I already can experience it sober.
Huh?
I can experience it sober.
Right, but it's not good for you and your brain.
Oh, any individual?
No, you. Well, any of it, that's my concern, is any of it, but you, no bueno.
I've already experienced it, and now I've experienced it without anything, which is really strange.
You know, this, I was just watching an interview with Lemmy last night to, like, because he died and wanted to.
He took a lot of acid because he was in Hawkwind.
And one of the things he said about acid specifically, he said, I got tired of seeing the same movie. And with LSD and most hallucinogens, and this, you sort of get the download, and once you've gotten the download, you get all this information, and then you need to apply that information to your life. And this is the famous Alan Watts quote: once you get the message, hang up the phone. You don't have to keep going back. But because people are, as you were saying earlier before we started recording, because many people have as their main goal not connecting to the present moment, but as much as possible shielding themselves from feeling anything, a lot of times people begin to use any substance, whatever it is, hallucinogens, cocaine, heroin, you name it, as a form of shielding themselves from feeling, you know.
Yes.
And that happens with everything.
Yes.
Not just, and not even, I mean, especially with phones,
yep,
too. Holy God, phones.
Process addiction.
Exact. Process addiction. I've never heard that before, but that's awesome. Mm. So, yeah, so I think that the key with hallucinogens, plant medicines, whatever the thing is, just understand that it's not enough to just read the book. And I think it is a form of book. I think it's a form of data storage in these substances.
And see, that's not how most people are taking it nowadays. I think they're
They're taking it to get high.
They're taking it to fix themselves.
Yeah, right.
Like, but I take something, it's going to fix me. Same as people take heroin nowadays, same as people take benzos.
Yeah. But
fix me rather than start to experience
interfere.
It out.
What? We're actually running out of time.
Shit. Right.
I know. We'll do another one.
Great.
Fine. Yeah. No,
just
see,
getting going here.
You understand?
But let me tell you my natural LSD story.
Hold on. You wrap, though, around these ideas, some religious ideas.
Sure.
So I'll let you finish with that, because Bob started with fuck all religion. I'm going to let you finish with how does religion help with reading the book.
Well, okay. I'm going to say religion, again, is a broad term.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm going to say what do many religions have at their core, and many religions at their core have the concept that you can, in some form or another, cultivate love inside of you, and that this love is not dependent on any external phenomena, and that the delusion that this love is dependent on external phenomena is what is causing so much suffering, maybe in your life, but also in the world. And so plant medicines, psychedelics, can help you get underneath the great callus that you've built around the part of yourself that used to feel, and realize that underneath the frozen ground of your heart,
back to Disney films,
there's still love down there. And yeah, and that once you connect to that and realize that underneath it all, that thing that you had when you were a kid, and which is what Albert Hoffman, when he talked about the first time he took a small dose of LSD before his massive dose made legendary on if you look up Bicycle Day, you'll know what I'm talking about. He said it made him feel like he was a kid playing in the woods again.
Yep.
And so that thing, and many people report this as feeling like a kid, is actually a feeling of being supported by a loving universe. And that is, to me, the point of anything at all, including all world religions, any psychedelic, anything at all. And I think that that is the X on the treasure map, and whatever gets you to that point is a wonderful thing. But you have to be a good scientist and look at the data, and if it's no longer getting you to that point, if it's not getting you to that point anymore, well, then it's outlived its use, and it's time to find some method that isn't dependent on a substance, which is where meditation comes in, finding a good meditation group, finding it some bona fide non-materialistic
service, and be service. Of service to your community.
Yes.
Here's my experiences. You know what walking with mindfulness is, right? Very slowly and feeling your feet on the ground. What I found spiritually pompous about that is that people only do that around other people at retreats.
Sure, sure, sure.
Right? And so I did it one night in Joshua Tree at my house, and I just started, but I wasn't doing it on purpose. I was feeling my feet on the earth, on the ground.
Yeah.
And I walked outside and I looked up at the stars, and I had a hallucinogenic experience that made me feel safe, a lack of fear, a lack of death, yeah. all those things. Sober, Drew.
That's it.
But flashback.
No, it wasn't.
Not a flashback.
Or we're getting a CAT scan.
No.
Or
no.
Carlos Castaneda was when he walked in his shoes that day.
We're getting a CAT scan.
You know what there was? A lack of technology.
Yeah.
Because I had no Wi-Fi. I had right. no cable TV. I was well, in it's the middle of the desert.
You were deprivation.
No reception. And I was not around people. Yeah. For a couple right. of days, and I really felt like the life is okay.
Yeah,
life
man,
life is beautiful.
That's it. You don't need these. This is the thing. A younger me, if it hurt, if
you know how many stars are up in the fucking sky.
No, I know.
It's amazing.
That's a lot, man.
All right, gentlemen, we will do this again. People like right. it. Write in. Where should they write in, Susan? Is there a place to write in if they have further questions or topics they want? This doctor.com.
I gotta go to Malibu.
What is it?
It's a long
contact
drive.
Contact doctor.com. And see, I knew you guys would.
What
hit
a blast,
it. I knew it'd be
man. Great
yeah.
chatting with you.
I knew it'd be yeah, great. I hope you all enjoyed it. You can wrap it up.
We're going to go. I'm going to Malibu. Drew's going. What are you going to eat? Dinner?
Dinner, yeah.
Okay. We're out of here. See you next time.
Lost in a tropic wave, seized with every motion as you slowly lose your clothes. Wanting you every way, perfection in a blanket, beaches of Mexico. What can I do for you? Erase all of your burdens so we never have to go. The sea, a seductive blue, only she can reach us on the beaches of Mexico. Oh, oh, you give in to me, I give in to you. Here, so near and free, just gazing. Kisses the beach.